and you're listening to Coast Community Radio, KMUN Astoria, 91.9 FM, and KTCB Tillamook, 89.5 FM, streaming at coastradio.org. You can listen on your mobile device using TuneIn. Coming up next, we've got Community Air. It is Josh Marquis, The Last Columbia Forum, and we've got Bedtime Stories coming up after that at 8. So give us a call, 503-325-0010. Donate today. Become a sustaining member. Renew your membership. Help any way you can.
I've been fortunate over... I was actually sworn in exactly 24 years ago today. Today is an important day in politics. Those of you who are not political junkies... Today was the filing deadline for the primary election. What that means for the Office of District Attorney is that people file, and if they didn't file as of 2 hours and 15 minutes ago, they are not eligible to run for election. So any ambivalence I had is gone. I did not file for re-election. Neither did anybody else except my chosen successor, Ron Brown, who has been my chief deputy for 14 years. And I think merits your vote, even if he is unopposed. To give you an idea, there are 18 district attorneys races up in, across the state. There's 36 counties. Two of them have opposition. I don't agree with the ACLU about much, but they have a campaign called They Report to You. And one of their theses is that nobody knows who their DA is. They're omnipotent, they're unaccountable, and they are basically a plug in the role for social justice. Some of those things are true, but I suspect in Clatsop County, whether people spit on the floor when they say my name or not, most of the voters, I think, probably had a pretty good idea of who I was and what I stood for. One of the real pleasures that I had and hope to continue to have is to go around the country. This is, I don't solicit these, but I get invitations. From usually groups of other prosecutors. Pennsylvania, Texas, California, Indiana, Kentucky. I think I've done about 19 states. And I find this really invigorating because they're young prosecutors, by my standards, 30 to their 30s and 40s, who are starting their careers. And frankly, like many professions, it's very isolating. As Steve says, people do not come and shower us with thanks and gifts, not that we can accept any over the value of $25, but it is not a job in which you want a lot of self-reinforcement. And contrary to one of the great myths of American pop culture, running for district attorney is a terrible idea if you have other future ambitions. There are 535 congressmen and women and senators. Less than 1% of them ever served in the job I have. I don't mean Clatsop County DA, I mean elected prosecutor. As Steve implied, you are going to upset at any given moment about 25% of the electorate. And in a small community, even more so, because you're either going to prosecute somebody who's a friend, who I've done over and over and over, people don't talk to me anymore, or ironically, you don't prosecute people, and that makes another group of people just as angry. And so you just can't, in a small community, there are many, many benefits of it, but there's also, you know, a few downsides. When I was thinking about this, this is, I think, the third and likely the last time I'll talk to the Columbia Forum, unless I distinguish myself in some hopefully positive fashion, that I could have given, you know, greatest hits of Josh Marquis and told you in grueling detail about the dozen or so murder cases I tried and which ones were the worst. And then Cindy reminded me that most of you have, you know, lived here for all your lives and you don't need me to basically reel off a resume. So I'm going to try to, I want to leave a significant amount of time to answer questions. And as they would say on Reddit, this is an AMA session. Ask me anything and I will be happy to answer it. This caveat or maybe non-caveat is I am not restrained tonight by any political purpose because I'm not running for re-election, nor do I have any intention of ever running for any other office. That doesn't mean that I don't intend to remain what Senator Johnson affectionately calls me, and I'm proud of, the district attorney from hell, which is how she advertises me around the Capitol. I can assure you some of her colleagues think of that in a very literal sense and want me to go there much faster. When I go around the country, And you know, in Texas, it's like 2,000 people. There's a jumbotron. In Utah, it's 20. So you get used to speaking to different size groups. So first I try to do is, okay, and if you, you know, I'm from Astoria. If you're well-read, it's Undaunted Courage by Stephen Ambrose. Unfortunately, I usually get a blank stare unless I associate it with Band of Brothers, in which case they may remember it. But then I'll say, well, have any of you seen Free Willy, Kindergarten Cop, or The Goonies? That nails it. Then they have a visual picture of where we are. And I sing the praises of Astoria being at the mouth of the beautiful Columbia River, et cetera, et cetera. And then, in connection with what Steve says, I explain briefly that my predecessor was arrested, indicted, convicted, recalled, and disbarred, and jailed. Not necessarily in that order. I think I missed the last couple up. So it's been easy for me to exceed people's expectations. All I really needed to do was not get indicted. So I think I'm confident that I'll get through the next 9 months. I'm not retiring before I retire. I'm in office until the 8th of January, and it appears I'll also probably stay on as a temporary employee to re-prosecute one of these cases that comes back after 20 years. But as I was getting ready, I was thinking of one of my very favorite poets and authors, T.S. Eliot, who is probably not most famous for my favorite work, T.S. or Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, if any of you are familiar with that. But from a quote from a more austere work of his called The Quartets, and I will try to do it justice, went to the end. It goes, "The end of our explorations is to arrive at the place we began and know it for the first time." And I really, in terms of self-reflection, sort of find myself doing that and realizing all the things that in some ways I took for granted when I started. You know, one of the questions, I did an interview with Steve Dunn that's going to air on Channel 2, I think in about 2 weeks. Probably a Sunday morning at 6:30, so you'd really have to want to watch it. And one of the, you know, there are a bunch of standard questions that reporters, no offense, Jack, ask. You know, what's changed the most? And I thought, technology. You know, we don't realize it, but, you know, this changes everything. I mean, even from cell phones 10 years ago. But people ask me what my greatest regret is. My greatest regret is not ever meeting Ursula Le Guin. Really, I believe at the time the greatest living American author and the author of my favorite book in the world, The Lathe of Heaven. And she has, I've been waiting years at one of the town halls for Ron Wyden or Jeff Merkley to be able to say this. And Merkley was here a few weeks ago and did one of these elected officials roundtables where everybody basically puts their hand out and says, can you get $5 million for fill in the blank? Answer is not if the other party is in control and in the presidency. So I always wanted to say this, and I turned to him and I said, you know, Ursula Le Guin was a great author, and my favorite quote from The Lathe of Heaven is she's setting up, it's set in a near future Oregon and on the coast. And she, it's a political observation made in 1970 when I believe Mark Hatfield and maybe Wayne Morse had just departed for Bob Packwood. And she said, the role of the senators from Oregon is to drive all the others mad. And as a result, no military butter is ever placed on Oregon's bread. And sometimes people say, well, where are your federal installations? Where are your army bases? I go, we don't have any of those. Riley is a National Guard base. There's a, you know, Air National Guard station at the airport, and there's Kingsley Field, Klamath Falls. But no, there's not a lot of military butter spread on the plate. When I came to the DA's office 24 years ago, there were three deputies and three other staff members, 6.5 employees. There are 20 today. Now, either you did massive empire building or things changed and improved. I'd like to think the latter. I've realized an interesting thing about leadership, which is the better you do in an organization like mine, the less indispensable you become. And I realize now that if I'm gone for a month, I don't think they really notice me that much because most of the daily work goes on and I don't have to sit there and crack the whip over their heads. So I urge you to vote for Ron. I suspect he's not the kind of person, to be blunt, who would probably come and address a group like this. It's just not his style. But he's a remarkable child abuse prosecutor. If you read the Daily Historian, you'd probably get the impression that all that we ever do is prosecute people for child pornography and horrible child sex crimes and send them to prison for extraordinary periods of time. And recently it's appeared that way. But I want to be clear that Clatsop County is a good place, and that does not define it, even though I'm proud of the fact that our police agencies are aggressive about that. We are aggressive about it. Columbia County is right next door to the east. Drive to Portland, you have to drive through Columbia County, unless you want to jump over to Washington. They have about 52,000 regular residents, and we have about 38,000. We have about 40 to 50% more crime than they do. Now, one possibility is that we're just crime infested and everybody here is out drunk driving and possessing and selling methamphetamine and worse, molesting their kids. That's not really true. It's mostly, frankly, tourists. The joke the defense bar likes to say is, come on vacation, leave on probation. And then apparently they add a new one, come back on a violation, which time we'll put you in prison. But, you know, that's because this exists in every community. This is the fourth place I've been a prosecutor. I started in Eugene. I went to Newport, where I ended up being chief deputy. I went to Bend, where I was chief deputy. And they're all great places. I loved living in all of them. But, you know, it exists. It exists. Some of you, those of you who work in nursing, know this. Physicians like Dr. Park know this. People in law enforcement know this. And, you know, there is a subculture that exists all the time. So I'm not running for an eighth term as district attorney, and I'm not here to tell you why I'm not. I'll answer the question if you have it. But the timing of this was necessitated by the fact that today was the deadline. And some people, I want to make clear, I didn't go out of my way to try to make I play a song at the end of every one of my jazz shows, which Steve is very kind to listen to, the first and third Mondays. And I start every show, to Cindy's great dismay, with Dave Brubeck's Take Five, a 1963 live cut from the Rondo a la Turk. And I end every show with a David Sanborn cut called The Long Goodbye. This is not intended as a speechifying long goodbye. I had to announce when I was leaving to give Ron Brown the opportunity to file so he could take the job. So the decision point was essentially, or the announcement point was essentially the first of January, or close to it. So rather than talking about all of the things that I think I've done, I want to talk a little bit about what's coming up in the county's future as it relates to the justice system, and what I hope you care about, because I do. And the mere fact that I'm not going to be in office does not mean I am not going to continue to submit op-eds to the Daily Historian. Now, they might be less inclined to print them because I'm no longer the district attorney, but I hope not. And I want to I hope to continue traveling around the country by invitation and continuing to do that. I find that really invigorating.
We'll still hold you to the word count.
You still hold me the word count. Well, you've been very generous with the word count, as opposed to the New York Times, which is brutal with the word count. You know, I served as president of the State DA's Association 18 years ago. That really dated me. And vice president of the National DA's Association, which I continue to do. So, you know, when I came here, we had two judges. Now we have three. That's a 50% increase. Two of those judges are former chief deputy DAs of mine, my number two. First, Cindy Matias, who was graceful enough to remain, even though she was a competitor for the governor's appointment in 1994, and stayed with me for a couple years. And then a woman I recruited from Portland named Dawn McIntosh, who ran for a newly created seat that Senator Johnson essentially got for us. So the idea that one of the reasons we have so many problems is, again, I'm not trying to dump on tourists. We actually legally call them transients. And a transient is somebody who lives either under the bridge or stays at the Stephanie Inn for $600 a night. It's a legal term. It means that people don't have a domicile in Clatsop County. And the Daily Historian's done some really good reporting on this, and 42% of everybody arrested for drunk driving in the county doesn't live here. To give you an idea of how wildly different that is, Deschutes County, Bend, which is also a large tourist community, has a 13% out-of-county rate for DUIs. So what that means is all of our system, the police agencies, the jail, the hospital to which anybody who blows over a .25, which you would essentially have to probably guzzle two bottles of wine during the course of the speech to get up to. The rule is they have to go to the hospital. So all of these services that we pay for, that we support, are essentially unsupported by the tourists. Now, I understand the tourists stay in the hotels, and I'm delighted with the renaissance of Astoria. You know, now when people come, I can say, well, if you have enough money, you can stay at, the Cannery Pier. But even if not, you can stay at the, Holiday Inn Express. And they look at me and I say, no, it's a really nice Holiday Inn Express. It's got these wonderful views. But the fact of the matter is that these people do contribute disproportionately. And it creates a real problem that is not likely to be easily solved. And although cases of child abuse are tough to talk about. I am pleased that there's with the Me Too movement, I hope has some resonance. I hope it's not merely a passing phase. And that doesn't mean I want to see more men nailed to a cross for an indiscretion, but it does mean that I am glad that now when a young woman, comes forward and gives a credible statement that she has been assaulted or raped, that the default will not be to not believe her, but to maybe say, you know what, this very well may have happened and we need to look into it. I can tell you, for the last 30 years of my life, I have spent standing in front of judges and juries pleading with them to believe the woman. Now, usually they do. Any lawyer that tells you they win all their cases, as Don can tell you, is either lying or they are cherry-picking their cases. The old joke is when the associate or deputy DA comes into you and says, I've never lost a case, I should get a promotion, you say, you know what, go out and lose a couple and come back. That really is, I can't remember a lot of the cases I've won. I remember vividly the major cases I lost. And I feel like I sort of failed those victims, although that's probably, taking way too much to myself. But we have seen, just in the time I've been DA, sea changes in attitudes, say, take drunk driving. Before MAD got started in 1979, drunk driving was a joke. I don't know how many of you remember Foster Brooks, the comedian? He used to be on Carson regularly. His whole shtick was, I'm drunk and the tree followed me down the street, et cetera. And everybody laughed. It was funny. Well, drunk driving is not funny anymore. Probably the most read part of the Daily Astorian is the, on the record section where locals who get arrested for DUI have their names printed. And I think there's a certain public shaming to that that's probably really good. Domestic violence is, I'd say, about 2/3 of the way there. Use popular culture. The honeymooners, to the moon, Alice, to the moon. Now it's like, ha, that's terribly funny. He's going to whack his wife. Well, not funny anymore. And it shouldn't be. Much farther along is something that's very near and dear to my heart, animal rights. Now, I am not a vegetarian. I thought the steak and the salmon were delicious tonight. And the usual line in the animal protection movement, which I'm involved in, is we don't eat our friends. And that's true. I did not know this steer or this salmon, and I'm sure they are destined for a better place. A lot of people again say, well, you did this because, you wanted higher political office. I have never sought any other job. There's one I do need to be, I'm going to be held to the record. In 2009, when President Obama was elected, I was one of what ultimately turned out to be two candidates for the United States Attorney. For those of you who don't know, the United States Attorney is essentially the federal district attorney for Oregon. It's a presidential appointment, although frankly, it's kind of a third tier one. It's not like being a judge for life. Normally the senators from the president's party nominate and then the president generally does that. Obviously I'm here, I didn't get picked. The other woman did. She left under less than ideal circumstances, but I'm genuinely grateful I didn't get it. I would have been part of a giant government bureaucracy where I would have had to listen to what somebody else thought was better, and I'm just not very good at that. I really admire people involved in the deliberative process. Cindy, Senator Johnson, any of you who serve on those kinds of essentially volunteer government boards. I'm not good at the deliberative process. The hierarchy in my office is a law firm. There's one partner and some senior associates. It's a constitutional monarchy. And that's the way it sort of needs to do. So I want to talk about things that are going to be on your plate that are coming up. And let's start with the jail. I know Steve is still writing editorials. I'm really hoping he'll do one or two, because Steve's quote, which I credit him for, is jails have no constituency. And that's true. I would doubt that more than four or five in you in this room would say, well, what do I want to do with $50, $48 or $49, which is what it will cost on a $200,000 assessed value house, and probably not going to be a jail. You're not going to think about a jail. You're not going to go to the jail, hopefully, and you won't go to the jail. Nobody you know will go to the jail. And 42% of them don't even live here. We are capped at 60 beds. We need at least 180 to 200. Now, there was an interesting commentary in the Daily Historian by a man who suggested what we really need is a psychiatric hospital. You know, not a bad idea. However, there is no such facility anywhere in Oregon. And if any place would have it, it would be Portland. They're certainly willing to self-assess them taxes. But to give you an idea of the cost of what it would take to run a 15 to 20 bed custodial psychiatric facility, my guess is the construction cost would be north of $40 million, or at least twice what the jail bond will be. And the operating costs would be at least $5 to $10 million a year, or about six times what it costs. This would be desirable, but you would need, instead of correctional officers, mental health counselors. And the other part to the proposal that I don't think was well thought out, but it's a natural reaction, and I've had people say, well, you know, why don't we provide care? Many of these people are mentally ill, they're drug addicts, you know, and that's true. 75% of everybody I prosecute has a substance abuse problem. They're not in jail for the substance abuse problem, but they have one, and it clearly contributes to the problem. So why not? Well, besides the money, the fact of the matter is that there are a certain number of people who commit crimes that are of such danger to the community that if you do not detain them at sometimes when they're at rock bottom, they will either kill themselves, kill somebody else, or destroy somebody else's lives. Now, there are not a lot of people. There's 39,000 people in the county, and less than 1% of them, or 1/20th of 1%, are in jail. And even if the facility was what it should be, 180, it would still be considerably less than 0.5%. Jail is not, it's totally different from prison. A jail is needed because 65 to 70% of the people there are accused but not yet convicted. And if they're in jail, and feel free, every day we do 1/15th, at least 5 days a week. And I do them myself, normally not a job that the DA takes, but we have to make decisions about who we release and who we don't. Every day, we release people charged with dealing heroin. We release people who burglarized your house. There really isn't even a question that we would release people who steal a car or break into a business. They're going to be out of custody before the officer gets back to his office to write the report. Now, a jail is a place where people who have demonstrated their inability or unwillingness to follow even the most basic rules are kept until you can have a trial. The legislature just passed a really bad bill that I won't go into a deep dive on because it's just too complicated, but essentially it means that we will no longer be able to require people, if they want to get out of jail without posting bail, to waive appearance on misdemeanors. People say, well, they would give up their right to appear in court. Well, yeah, because if they don't, what happens is they show up, they fail to appear. They're arrested, they fail to appear. They fail to appear. You can't have a trial. Eventually, the case will be dismissed. That probably doesn't matter too much with a minor shoplift or a disorderly conduct where somebody gets in a fight. But other misdemeanors include not just the first drunk driving, but the second. Not just domestic violence, but strangulation. Cases where people are really at risk. I mean, the classic situation, guy comes over from Gresham. beats up his girlfriend at the Shiloh and Seaside. And because he doesn't have a record, the jail lets him out. Tells him to come back on X date. Guess what? There's at least 35% chance statistically he will not show up. So he doesn't show up. Warrant goes out for his arrest. Somehow he gets stopped again somewhere in Oregon. It's brought over. This cycle goes on two or three times. But we have no room in the jail. So now what will happen is two or three or four years will go by. Then he'll get caught again, probably because he did something he wasn't supposed to. Then his lawyer will put him on the stand and he'll say, well, I've lived in Gresham for the last 3 years at the same address. And the judge, any judge, will say, well, Mr. Markey, or Mr. District Attorney, whoever that will be at the time, what's your response to this? Did you go hunt him down? We'll say, well, no, we didn't know he lived at that address and he hasn't showed up for five times. Well, the state is a unity in the eyes of the law. I am the police, I am the state, the Portland police, the Crook County Sheriff's Office is me. We all theoretically interface and know what each other are doing, even though that's a complete factual fiction. So what the judge will say, because it's the law, is you didn't bring this guy to trial within this period of time. I'm dismissing the case with prejudice. That means the case is gone forever. And there is no record. A lot of what we do is what I call resume building. Not the kind of resume you'd want, but many times we recognize people do. Oregon has one of the lower incarceration rates in the country. We're in the bottom third. We are, you know, I know there's a lot of concern, and rightfully so, about what is often called mass incarceration. And as a society, we have more people in jail than Germany per capita, or Iceland, or other largely homogeneous societies. And any of you who've gone to Europe know this, even in the most democratic countries, I've lived overseas in Italy and England for extended periods of time. If you travel, no matter who you are, certainly if you're a non-citizen, but even if you're a citizen, you have to register with the innkeeper. I mean, if this was Italy, a country I adore, and I wanted to travel the equivalent of from Venice to Perugia, I'd have to give my national identity card to the hotel manager. He would then make a photocopy of it, give it to the Carabinieri, the national police, and they would know exactly where I've been. Now, most Americans wouldn't tolerate that for a moment. They would say, well, you know, I have a First Amendment freedom of association and travel. How dare you monitor me like that? So, you know, I think it's very difficult to compare the United States. There was a piece on 60 Minutes last night that Senator Johnson told me, says, call up, it'll make you really angry. and it did. It was about a program in Germany for prisons, which, you know, looked like, you know, frankly, a spa. And it was a contract killer who was, you know, having ice cream outside of the prison. You know, I kind of wish we could do that, but we can't. I'm not saying we can't improve our society. I think we have a pretty civil society here in Clatsop County. I think people do look out for each other. You know, you think back of the storm of 2007, KMUN kept us all connected, not the AM radio station, but people generally care for each other. I have what I call the food pyramid of crime. You know, I don't think they use the food pyramid anymore, but generally the food pyramid of crime is you know, you're supposed to eat stuff that I never eat, you know, like, or rarely eat, except when Cindy berates me. Apple, you know, fruits, grains, good stuff. And then above that, you know how it works, and then sweets and fats are at the top. You're not supposed to eat that much. Well, the criminals pretty much fit that pattern. You have about 75% of everybody, I mean soup to nuts, drunk driving to murder, who are not really evil. They are not fundamentally bad people. They are lazy, drug addicted, alcoholics. They make consistently bad choices. But, you know, with some intervention and some willingness to do the work themselves, they could get better. Now, they often don't, because they continue to make bad choices, and some things in our society disincentivize the right thing. Some people really recover. I won't name a name, but many of you in a small town will know it. One of the guys I repeatedly sent to prison in the 90s for being a cocaine dealer is today a very successful house painter, and, you know, has a thriving business with a bunch of crews, and I'm delighted for him. It's great. There's another man who is now a therapist. I work with him in drug court, which I work every Monday afternoon. He talks about me sending him to prison for 8 years. He actually went to prison, and he says it saved his life. Now, I didn't save his life. He did the work. So why do we need a jail? Because the jail is the default. 75% of everybody convicted of a felony in the state of Oregon never goes to prison. The common mythology is, oh, person's convicted for burglary, car theft, dealing drugs. They're going to go to prison. Not generally in Oregon. Prison population is, in fact, flat now. The projection when I ran for office was that the Oregon State Prison would be at 18,500 10 years ago. The prison population is 15,000. 3,500 less is two entire prisons that never had to be built. So this idea that Oregon is rushing towards mass, we are not Texas, we are not Louisiana, and we are not Florida. One of the myths that I like to debunk is, oh, people who are convicted of felonies, their lives are over, they're ruined, they're branded with a scarlet, F for felon. Oregon is one of, I think, 12 or 13 states that the moment you're no longer in prison, you can vote. You're a convicted rapist on parole, in the jail, doing time for a parole violation, send your ballot in, not a problem. I don't even care about it, but my point is, that is not the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom is that people, and with almost without exception, except for the most serious crimes, people can move to have that felony set aside after 3 years. And I probably see, 40 of these a month, and I sign off on about 90% of them saying, no objection, no objection, no objection. But those laws, I think, Steve was nice enough to give me a forum, need to be changed. You should be aware that a man who beats a child, I had this case happen actually about a month ago, he beat up a child so severely the child had fractured skull and long-term repercussions from it. It was his own child, 8 years old. We convicted him of felony assault in the third degree. I don't think he even did prison time. He had it hanging over his head. He applied to have that erased off his record. I can't stop it. We can all agree that crimes like a shoplifting, even a car theft, somebody leads a good life, they're not committing more crimes, they should be able to get a fresh start. Makes sense to me. I'm sign off on it all the time. But what about somebody who, commits statutory rape? In this case, it was a 21-year-old having sex with a 15-year-old girl. Wiped off the record. When I say wiped off the record, I mean you won't be able to find it. It's wiped off the record of the courts. So that guy does it again in 5 years. The police look up the record. It's not there. He's never done it. It's changing history. It's changing the truth. Errol Morris, who is a great documentary filmmaker, did The Thin Blue Line as well as a number of other wonderful movies, has a saying I love. There is no truth for me and truth for you. There is only the truth. And, in this political climate, the idea that you can spin everything or that everything's got a relative truth or a fake truth, there is such a thing as objective reality. It's 7:45 and we're sitting in Clatsop County and just had a great meal and we're with the people we're with. It's not like we're in another place. It's not an alternate dimension. Things can be quantified. Oregonians have passed sentencing laws, which some people think are really harsh. Measure 11. Any of you heard about Measure 11? Measure 11, too tough, ties judges' hands. Well, Judge McIntosh recently, front page, above the fold, gave a guy who was spying on teenage girls for a decade in Surf Pines. Some of the most devastating victim testimony I've ever heard outside of a murder case. Gave him 35 years. Now, that's not the minimum sentence. That's what Judge McIntosh chose to give him because she felt that he should get 7 plus 7 plus 7 plus 7 plus 7. What Measure 11 does, voters passed it in 1995 by a 62% margin. 6 years later, petitions were brought to repeal it. Voters this time rejected it in Oregon, 75%. There is an attempt going on right now in the Oregon legislature saying, oh, brain development is different for kids. Probably is. Since 1995 in Oregon, when a juvenile commits a very serious crime. Now, we're talking about armed robbery, rape, not statutory rape, rape of a child under the age of 12, or a homicide, not burglary, not drugs. That's when Measure 11 applies. And if it's a juvenile, what we do is they don't go to adult prison, ever. So a 17-year-old that commits a violent rape would receive a 8-year sentence and serve every day of it in the Oregon Youth Authority. Not in the one here anymore, because the Oregon legislature and governor, in infinite wisdom, decided to close it. Not a good thing. But my point is, when I started as a prosecutor, it was very common to have judges impose 20-year sentences for burglary, which is an astonishingly long period for somebody who breaks into an unoccupied house. Let's say a house in Surf Pines where people only live 3 months out of the year. Everybody knew it was a lie, at least everybody in the courtroom. Judge knew the person wasn't going to do 20. They weren't even going to do 10 or 5. The defendant was probably told by his lawyer he wouldn't do it. Prosecutor sure knew about it. You know who didn't know that? The victim and the community. Because victims had no rights until 1986 in Oregon. The story I tell frequently at these seminars that I give for other lawyers, I say, and it's a true story, I said I was what I call third chairing, meaning I was just carrying the bags, of a more senior prosecutor in 1982 in Eugene. And a young woman from Alpha Chi Omega, which is a sorority on campus, I think it's probably still there, had been raped by a stranger. And we had gone to trial, we had convicted him of rape. The maximum sentence for rape under Oregon law is technically 20 years, although really now they get 8. And there's a centuries-long process called allocution. Allocution is the right of the defendant to say, oh, please, judge, don't chop off my hand or my head. It's a plea to the king, to the sovereign, not to be harsh. And it's always existed. It's an important part. You've all seen it on television. Is there anything you wish to say before I sentence you? Yes, there is, judge. You know, the prosecutor really did it if it was on television. In this case, there was a young woman sitting next to me, the young woman, the victim. She stands up after the defendant and says, Your Honor, I'd like to give a statement. And the judge says, young lady, sit down and be quiet. You have no standing here, no right to speak, and if you continue, I'll have no choice but to hold you in contempt. Now, when I tell this story to groups of prosecutors, many of whom are women, roughly half now, there's gasps. They're horrified. And I know exactly what a mean, terrible judge. What a thoughtless man. No, he was simply carrying out the law until 1986, or more properly, 1999, when it was made part of the Oregon Constitution. Victims had no rights. No rights to be there, no right to even be in the courtroom, no right to speak, certainly no right to be consulted by people like me. And frankly, a lot of prosecutors opposed these laws because they thought, oh my goodness, we're going to have to spend hours on the phone with some hysterical woman explaining to her why we're doing a plea bargain. Yeah, you know what? We do have to spend hours on the phone explaining to a victim why we're doing a plea bargain. And that's the way it should be. And we now have 2.5 victim assistants in our office. A lot of places do. It's required in Oregon now. And it's a good thing. I would rather get a 24-month prison sentence for, say, someone on their sixth identity theft and embezzlement, I'm not exaggerating, than have them serve. They would serve 80% of it. They get 20% off for good time, so 24 months, roughly 5-6 months off. So they'd serve 19. Rather than get a 5-year sentence where they really only serve 25 months. Now, if you could follow my math, the second sentence, the one I didn't want, was actually longer than the first, but it wasn't true. It was a lie, or it was a construct. And I don't think that's ever good. The other reason we need a jail is because of its current state of mental health, which is abysmal. The county does not spend any of its own money on mental health. They pass through approximately $3 million a year, which is 50% bigger than my entire budget, from federal and state money. And they outsource it to Clatsop Behavioral Health, which does its best. I handle personally almost all of the involuntary commitments, which are called PAMIs, persons alleged to be mentally ill. And I've been harshly corrected that we used to call them AMIPs, alleged mentally ill people, which if you write this down is literally the same words as just rearranged. And I've been harshly reprimanded by some mental health people saying, they are not AMIPs anymore, they're PAMIs. I said, okay, if that's what you want. In order to be involuntarily committed in Oregon, you have to be, to use a technical expression, batshit crazy. It's not enough that you simply have an odd lifestyle, that you're hoarding, that you hear voices. You must A, be mentally ill as diagnosed by a physician or someone sufficiently competent to give a diagnosis, a DSM-5, the Diagnostical and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which is like a cookbook. Instead of saying, you know, one cup of flour, it's what are the 6 signs of an antisocial personality? I won't, you know, being mean to animals, consistent cruelty, fire setting, all these kinds of things. Again, I realized I didn't complete the food pyramid. Those 75%, those people can be reached. The next group up is 10, 15%. They're professional criminals. They're drug dealers who don't use. They make money. They know they might get caught. They make a calculation that it's going to be okay. And at the very top of the pyramid are the ones we're all afraid of. The sociopaths, the antisocial personalities. They're not psychopaths. They are not people who, instead of when they strangle their wife, they think they're actually squeezing a lemon. I mean, they really actually think that. That person is so mentally ill, we don't hold them legally responsible in our legal system. I'm talking about people who just don't care. Now, they're thankfully rare, but they are really scary. And I have prosecuted, you know, I probably know more than 20 or 30 out of the thousands of cases I've handled. But they're the most dangerous because essentially, as a mental health person will tell you, if they're being candid, there is no treatment. There is no medication. Bipolar can be treated. Schizophrenia can be treated. So what do we do about mental health in Clatsop County? I think first, the county's got to put some skin in the game. Not a huge amount. County budget's like $50 million. Of which they go out of their way to point out correctly that only about 15 million of it is truly discretionary. But if the county were to fund, say, 2 mental health workers, or 3, and maybe $350,000 a year, do outreach, we've got a serious problem with the homeless in this community. You all see them. Some of them are like Helmet John. We know him, we like him, you know, he has a drink with Cindy at the, you know, and has his, Astoria Coffee House, but then some of them are urinating and doing other things in the alcove that once was the Penny's building. Or they confront you as you're, you know, trying to leave Carruthers with a pack of dogs that they've picked up somewhere. And they're very aggressive. And, I, you know, they're not throwaway people. But if we need to do something, and the warming center, while valiant, is not enough. Now, let me be clear. In our society, we do not incarcerate people for being mentally ill. And you can't. You can't even detain someone, and nor should you be able to. If the state deprives someone of their liberty, we have to accord them due process, and we do. I've got a PAMI hearing on Thursday. And I can discuss it. This guy is totally delusional. He believes the Russians and the Koreans are speaking to him through nanotechnology that's been implanted. And not just that, but they're giving him what we call command hallucinations. They're telling him what to do. Now, he's not a criminal, but he's a dangerous person with a serious mental illness. But we have no place to put him. The respite center, which is great, has no secure beds. So what happens at the respite center is, if somebody doesn't have a home or they need sort of like, I don't know, like sort of assisted living kind of for the mentally ill. There are people who work out there who, you know, try to help out. But if somebody says, I'm leaving, in the middle of the night, they're not allowed to touch them. They're not allowed to lock the door. They're not allowed to detain them anyway. They call the Warrenton Police Department. And maybe the Warrenton Police Department catches them. I did one recently where the woman was absolutely intent on slitting her throat. The crisis center workers followed her to Fred Meyer and literally did this with her while she was trying to grab for the razor blades or box cutters. And finally, a police officer showed up. So although we can't afford this psychiatric hospital that was proposed in the newspaper, we can do better. And frankly, I wish the hospitals, both of them, CMH and Providence Seaside, would step up and provide safe rooms. I get it why they don't. It's a bad business decision. These are people who probably have an Oregon health plan. They're crazy, they're loud, they're scaring everybody, they're threatening the nurses. You know, the last thing you ever want to do in a hospital is threaten the nurses. It's a really bad idea. But they're not in our reality. So I get it. The hospitals would rather cater to people with broken legs and other things that, you know, where they can actually treat them. But what do we do with these people? We can drive them out. We can scoot them like, you know, brushing off your front porch and, you know, putting the leaves in your neighbor's yard. And I've heard stories for years that Portland does this to us. They actually buy one-way bus tickets. And I've got a lot of people say, why don't we do the same back to them? We could do that. We could just line them up and give them bus tickets and send them back to Portland. But that's just avoiding the problem. That's like, you know, moving, you know, the junk in your house from one side of the room to the other. And I'm not saying the people are junk. I'm saying it's a problem. And to think it will just spontaneously solve itself will not work. And people say, well, why do people come here? Why do you come here? Why do we live here? It's a great place. Views are wonderful. Climate's relatively mild. You know, thank you for all coming, because last time it was too perilous to show up for this thing because there was ice and snow everywhere, but that's unusual. So the county needs to get in the game. Would $350,000 out of a $3 million a year budget make that much difference? No, it's a 10% increase. But it would outreach workers that would go out perhaps and ask questions and say, hey, have you signed up with Clatsop Community Action? You know, do you know where you can get clean clothes? That's critical. The drug problem we have, it's massive. Our opioid problem is not really, it is not any more OxyContin, because frankly, doctors have in Oregon have become much, much more responsible. I haven't seen a pharmaceutical pill in a drug arrest in 7 years. You know why? Heroin is really cheap. It's $3 to $5 a dose. When I worked narcotics, when I was much younger, like 40 years ago, heroin sold for $25 in the mid-1970s, which you can figure out how much that'd be today. It was about one-fifth as potent. Methamphetamine, New York Times did a story a week ago with a Portland cut line on it, talking about how meth is bigger and worse than it was 10 years ago. We succeeded in getting rid of the Beavis and Butthead labs. That's what we call people who would go to Costco and buy a vat of pseudoephedrine and then go to their check into a cheap motel and cook up a batch of meth. It might blow up, but in any event, they can't do that anymore. They can't get the precursor chemicals. So what happens? You know, supply and demand. Mexican drug cartels in Mexico cook it up in 55-gallon vats and send it here. I see people devastated by meth all the time. So what do we do about that? The Oregon legislature decided to decriminalize it. They have said that possession of less than 2 grams of heroin is now a misdemeanor. 2 grams of heroin, one of the drug cops told me, I said, well, how do they sell it these days? I mean, because I haven't really had much interaction. Drug cases I find boring, and I have other deputies that get to do it for me. They said they sell it by points. I said, what's a point? It's a tenth of a gram. So 2 grams is 20 dose units. So in Oregon, if you're caught with 20 dose units, it's a misdemeanor. Guess what you're not gonna do? You're not gonna go into drug court. Drug court's a great idea. Drug court, you're charged with your third drug offense, and you probably won't go to prison, but your life's gonna mess up. If you go into drug court, voluntarily seek treatment, eventually get 90 days clean time, and do what you're supposed to, we dismiss the charge entirely. But it's leverage. The leverage we have is, hey, you could be charged with a felony. Leverage gone. That is not right by a long way. I'll talk a little bit about gun violence, which is extremely controversial. And I consider myself kind of a moderate. I own a firearm, but it is not an unlimited right. The Second Amendment does not say I can have as many guns as I want. You can't regulate me at all. Alcohol is legal, but it's regulated. It's regulated by where it can be consumed, who can consume it. People like to say, well, they don't say how much alcohol you can get. Well, that's true. But, you know, Steve was in the Marines. The lethality is directly related to basically magazine size. if you have a 30-round clip in an AR-15, or frankly even a Ruger 10/22, because it's the question of a semi-automatic weapon, you can kill a lot of people really fast. And that seems to me to be an easy one. So does background checks. If we don't want criminals and crazy people to have guns, we have to institutionally be able to know who they are. If you say, nope, we're not going to allow that, it's my absolute freedom, and it can't be regulated by government, that is not what Heller versus District of Columbia says. That's the most recent United States Supreme Court case, which in fact ruled against the District of Columbia and said you can't just blanket. But, you know, frankly, the political posturing on both sides is just is offensive, even though I'm a politician. I want to close at least my remarks by, I know I paint a sometimes depressing picture of the community. My mother is still very much alive at age 95. She doesn't create art anymore, which my father died 13 years ago, almost exactly of Parkinson's at age 86. My parents, who are far more politically liberal or progressive or whatever the word is these days than I am, despaired of my choice of profession. I mean, they were proud that I was a lawyer, but they thought, oh, I'm in a moral abyss. I'm just surrounded by nothing but death and violence and degradation all the time. My soul's going to be sucked into a black hole. I don't find that at all, particularly at the end of my exploration and where I'm arriving at this place that I never saw before, or I didn't see it the same way. In 1999, we had a rash of horrible car crashes on 26. Where highly intoxicated drivers, usually on what we call polypharmacy, meaning they were on methadone, marijuana, methamphetamine, and alcohol. Really bad combination for a bunch of reasons. And any of you drive 26 know it's really dangerous. You come around some of those curves, particularly between about milepost 5 and 20, and you better pray nobody's in the oncoming line because you just don't have time. That summer, we lost at least 6 people within a 5-mile stretch. And I remember Cindy and I were coming back from a party in Lake Oswego that day. I got home, phone rings. We've got an awful crash. What had happened is a guy named James Little, who had previously been convicted of killing 2 other people in a drunk driving crash and served 1 whole year in jail for it in Portland, had been using all the drugs I mentioned, had come around a blind corner in the entirely wrong lane. The family he ran into was in a van. It was a mother, father, 2 children. Hit them, neither of them slowed down. They were going 60 miles apiece. And as the, you don't have to be a mechanical engineer to understand that they basically collided at 120 miles an hour. Of course, the drunk driver escaped unharmed, was thrown from the car, not wearing a seatbelt. It was summer. There were a lot of tourists, including a female New Jersey state trooper who stopped and aided. If there was any mercy in the case, the mother and father died instantly. One of the kids lingered for about a day or two, and the other was relative named Ben, was unhurt largely. I mean, other than obviously losing his family. And one of the things I try to do in these cases is I go to the family's home and try to, you know, assess, you know, do you really want this case to go to trial? Do you want me to do a plea bargain? So I went to Tigard, where they lived, and Ben was living with his aunt and uncle. And the whole family had gathered together, and I wanted to find out if Ben could even take it, being on the witness stand. And, you know, it's my decision as a prosecutor, not theirs, what to do, but I wanted them to be informed. So I'm not really good with kids. And so I was trying to find something to find sort of a common denominator. And in this case, I started talking about cats, because I love cats. And Ben perked up and said, oh, yes, I have a cat. I said, oh, is the cat around here? Oh, I can give it a rub. He said, no, my aunt and uncle are allergic. The cat lives in the house where nobody lives. And this was an epiphany for me. Even though I'd been a prosecutor for 25 years at the time, I realized this little boy was talking about a house where his parents had the bedroom, all of his clothes were, his brother's clothes, everything. It was the house of the dead. He's never going to go back there. And I still start crying when I mention it because... So I asked the family, you know, they didn't want Ben to go on the witness stand, and I was able, because of Measure 11, to secure a 16-year prison sentence, which means he does every day of it. So at the sentencing, they played a video celebrating the lives of this family. They were deeply religious, deeply Christian, and forgiveness was a big part of that. And they asked me if they could give them a Bible, and I was explaining the protocols in the courtroom. There's no, for obvious reasons, people can't just go up to somebody in custody and say, oh, here's this, boom, or whatever. I said, but you can give me the Bible. I'm going to open it to make sure there's, you know, nothing in it, unoffensive, and I'll give it to him. It was a beautiful, you know, really expensive Bible with gilt pages, and on the inside flap, they had embossed a family photo. From obviously when the people were all alive. So I gave it to them, and they basically stated forgiveness, and it was lovely. He still got 16 years, and when I went out, the Portland TV stations were here, and just like on the, they're all, well, what do you think? And I said, what do you think of that forgiveness? I said, well, that forgiveness is wonderful. I said, I don't know if I'd be capable of it, but I'm reminded of the Bible where it says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar, and render unto God what is God's. And at the moment, Caesar wants 16 years of Mr. Little's life. Of course, that is what in journalism we call a soundbite. And it was, of course, what KETU and KGW. So Cindy and I are watching the news when we were younger and could stay up till 11 o'clock. And Cindy, of course, they played this clip. And so Cindy says, oh, so you think you're Caesar, do you? So I said, no, I just represent Caesar in court. But the happy ending to this story is I often lose track. This kid lived in Portland, and the case was over. There was not a trial. And about 2 years ago, one of my victim assistance people came up to me and said, do you remember Ben? And I said, yeah. I said, he just got married and had a kid, and showed it to me on Facebook. And I never forget, frankly, the kindness, generosity of spirit, forgiveness that I often don't have, and frankly, I don't think you want me to have. My job, I'm not an agent of the divine, I'm an agent of the state. And my job has been to assess accountability and to make people think that they live in a community where we have one kind of justice for everybody. And I hope I've done that. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.